and welcome to Game Brain, a board game podcast about our gaming group. I'm your host, Tom Donnelly, and I am sitting in front of me with two wonderful people. Before we do anything else, I want a deep cleansing breath in and out. We're just going to have a Hopi Indian woman come in and burn sage. We've had some tough times here. We got some things we can talk about, some things we can't. Last night, a conversation was brought. Oh, let me introduce some people first, and then we'll get into this.
Ooh, I'm so excited. I don't even know what this is about.
Oh, it was a nothing burger, but it was actually...
here last night, and I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, in a moment.
Wow, we are starting in.
Probably can tell, my co-hosts today are the one, the only, the magnificent Ben Mandelker.
Hello there.
And the voice of his generation, Dimitri Portnoy.
Me? I thought you were talking about someone wonderful.
You are. I'm not. Completely wonderful, Dimitri. And it is good to have you on the podcast.
It's great to be here.
So,
what happened? I wasn't here,
I'm making a way bigger deal out of it than it was. It was absolutely nothing. It was actually just one of those hilarious, hilarious moments, which is that we had 12 people. We've been having, 12, 13 people on Friday night.
Sounds like a good Friday.
They get boisterous, okay? Mm-hmm. And we started with Avalon because only 10 people were here because the Masters of Disaster, the Kananek brothers, were both late.
Wow. Much like I was today for this podcast recording.
We did the deep cleansing breath. We're past that. That is 100% past. Water firmly under the bridge.
Under
it's
the
a frozen
bridge?
River.
Firmly under the bridge.
Okay. I'm just trying to picture it. Maybe it's some kind of barrage expansion. I'm
a
not
bridge
aware
over
of.
Firm
are you,
water.
Are you not aware of ice?
It is ice
over.
Oh.
Firm water. Look at that, guys. Ice, yo! You forgot about ice.
It's April, Tom. It's a little too late to talk about ice.
Last week was freezing in LA.
It was.
It was so cold. I was dying. So we had this little thing that happened where people said that we should... I think Matt Robinson is...
doesn't love Avalon.
He's a stirrer of nonsense from time to time. Oh. He would like to instigate things.
Okay.
We consider you, Ben, an Avalon convert, officially.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have fun playing it, yeah.
Yeah, you used to agree with Matt.
I see its downsides, but I've grown to enjoy it. Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
very diplomatic.
Inculcation.
So before we even play Avalon, Trey says, listen, by the way, I'm not the only curmudgeon around here. Matt's quite the curmudgeon, too.
Mm.
To which Matt took some amount of umbrage.
Wow.
And said, I am not a curmudgeon, blah, blah, blah. And he gives his bona fides for not being a curmudgeon, though he did it in quite a curmudgeonly way, which we point out to him. And we say, listen, we are not comparing your level of curmudgeonly behavior to Trey's. There is no comparison.
Are we relitigating a fight from last night on the podcast without Matt here? Is that what's happening?
No. Without anybody being here.
No. Because then what it morphs into is we should be talking about what are the phrases that we use for all of the people. Like, so Trey's a curmudgeon and Matt's a...
Okay,
and
okay.
And
rebranding, if
and
you will.
So we said things like, this is... Like, what was the Dimitri one? There were several that were thrown out.
Handsome bastard.
I didn't hear any of them.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yes.
Because you might still be holding on to some of those. Some of those were very hurtful.
Wait, what platitude did I receive?
You weren't here, so you were spared the brunt of this. But no, but it was things like, let's not have a Gillison moment.
I remember yours, Tom. Would you like me to say that?
Well, here's the thing. I was setting you up for that because I said, let's not have a Gillison moment. Everybody laughed. And then Gillison, in a heartbeat,
skewered you. He just owned you.
He was armed and ready. I brought a knife to a gunfight.
Uh-oh.
Because he immediately said,
the Tom Teach.
He said, the Tom Teach.
The Tom Teach.
The Tom Teach is when Tom teaches the game perfectly, except the strategy he plans to employ against you. And I have a perfect example of that. I have a perfect example of a Tom Teach, Tom.
So, by all means.
You may remember the little game we've been playing called Station Fall.
Yes.
Right? And the first time we played it, it was Tom, you, me, and Kananak. You made me lose by having your character...
I made him lose.
Yes. Well, that's the object, right? But you had the character in the game enter the life pod of my person and drag like her outside.
I just like this whole sentence. This says, yes. You had a character who entered the life pod of my character and drag her out.
Yes, dragged her outside. And it wasn't only from Jordan when we played the game next time that I learned you cannot do that. You can only drag a character who is down or an inanimate object. You cannot drag a character who is
standing and living.
And I
would never, ever, ever want to contradict you, Dimitri, but your character in that scenario was down.
No.
Yes.
No, absolutely not. Who died? She walked into the pod. How was she down if she walked into the pod?
She hit her head on the way in.
Okay. So, yeah, gaslight me all you want. But the thing is, there is very much such a thing as a Tom Teach. Because Tom, you delivered it in your mellifluous baritone.
That's
so convincing and so entrancing and hypnotizing.
Dimitri is dragging you over you dragging his character.
He absolutely is. Which is
you
why
you can't
I say,
do it. You can't do it.
Deep cleansing breaths. And out.
Dimitri has clearly been holding on to this injustice. I wanted to mention it
because in that second play, I wanted to drag. I wanted
Dimitri wanted to have
my
vengeful
character, my
of
character,
everyone.
To be voluntarily dragged by another character into a life pod, and I thought that may not work. I thought maybe it may not be again. It may be
you wanted to be like a dragging. Like a draggy Freddy Krueger. Like he was dragged in one life, and so he comes back from the dead and drags everyone.
I wanted to like be
physically
a drag
drags people
queen. You wanted I wanted to use that.
You
and
just wanted
said, no, you cannot do that. And it was only later that I put together why that idea was planted in my head.
There needs to be an expansion where there's a character whose goal is to just drag as many people as possible. They literally just like knock them out and drag them from room to room, and they get some sort of token when it happens. And like you're just dragging people around the spaceship. I don't know why, but I think it would make Dimitri very happy.
I think it would. I think it would. Yeah. So anyway, in the span of like 2 minutes, 10 different things were thrown out, and then we play Avalon. It was fantastic. We haven't played Avalon on a Friday game night. We never play it on a Tuesday game night, but on a Friday game night, we usually start with Avalon, and we haven't done that in like 3 weeks because we've had
too many people.
14 people.
It's too popular.
Something along those lines. So the fact that we got to do it last night and forced Matt to play, and Matt played very well.
Oh, good.
He committed 100% to the
bit. He's a committer.
He was Mordred, and he ended up unfortunately being on the team and having to be the first person to fail a mission, which is always a hard thing as Mordred. And we, Lady of the Lake Tim, found out that he was Mordred, called him out, and he committed to the bit the whole way.
Good for him.
Hard job to do. He did great.
It is, yeah. Well, that sounds fun. What else did you play last night, by the way? Can I have FOMO?
Of course. Yes, of course you can have FOMO. So the three games, Candace Harris came by and brought her demo copy of her playtest copy of Stage Left.
Mm-hmm.
And she played that with Dimitri, Jake, and Nick.
Yes.
Great. Did you have fun playing it?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, I'm excited to
how
see
were the. We'll ask about the adjustments to it because she's made several adjustments to it and had it to play versus 2 weeks ago.
Sure.
So we'll talk about that in a second. Matt brought out Earth, one of the new hotnesses.
I saw it was trending on BGG for a little bit now, but I just didn't think anything. I just sort of was like, that's probably a Kickstarter. And I've just been very busy the past 2 weeks. And just I was like, I was not taking on too much information about new games. And then last week, when I was up in the Bay Area and I was having my own little game day, which I'll tell you all about, my friend was saying, oh, I heard that Earth just killed Ark Nova. It's the Ark Nova killer. And I was like, what? And I still haven't actually had the time to like research it, but now I'm fascinated by it. So I'm really excited to hear what you have to say about it.
Yeah, well I didn't You'll play talk. That.
Okay.
So I can't really speak to it much, but I can tell you what people have said about it. And I can tell you from my own research why I think they're probably right about it.
Ooh.
Which is, it's not a bad review. It's just a not for us review kind of thing.
Okay.
But, you know, listen, we'll be doing a review on it. So we'll have, so this is more just like very initial impressions. And then there were four other people, myself, Claude, Jordan, and Paul, who played Vladimir Suhi's Shipyard.
Love it. We played it with, I played that with you a few months ago.
Yes. I love that game. I thought, I was like, Jordan's never played that game.
Really?
I want to introduce him to that game. He didn't love it. He liked it very much, but he didn't love it.
He recently told me he's very up and, maybe like, not up and down, but like, I think it's sort of when it comes to Suhi games, it's not always a match for him.
Well, he's only played, I think he's only played Praha and Woodcraft. And he said that this was reminding him a lot of Woodcraft, which is interesting because the designs are a decade apart and and quite different. But there are some, I see what he was talking about. There are some crossovers. I just love Shipyard.
That's really great. And you know that there's a new version coming out.
I do.
There's like a revised version. I don't know if the rules are going to be that much different, but the components are going to be different.
I heard about that. One of the reasons I brought it out to play was that I was like, I want to get back into Shipyard. I very much dig that game.
The new art, sorry to meet you. The new art that I saw, like maybe prototype art, is that the ships are kind of like you're looking bird's eye view down, as opposed to right now the current version or the original version is like profile of the ship, so you're actually like looking at ships as if you were to draw them on paper. So the new one looks like the art that they're at least maybe experimenting with is maybe top down. And some people online were being really rude about it. They're like, oh, it looks like a bunch of surfboards. I was like, I actually think it looks really cool top down too. And so I'm down for all perspectives of those ships.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. I love ships. They're beautiful things. I'd be way down for that.
Really glad I got that out of my system. I'm really glad I got to take a stance on the top down view of those ships on the new artwork.
Deep cleansing breath in and out.
Check that one off the list. It's been on my mind for a few weeks.
We're knocking things out today. Okay, yeah. This is a therapy session. Dimitri, what were the changes to Stage Left? If you could just, you know, people haven't played it, obviously, because it doesn't exist yet in any form except the prototype. But how do you feel that the game is evolving from the last play to this play?
The second version was more polished. The iconography was clearer. There was a lot of confusion that was that I had that was solved, and some of the overpowered rule breaking cards, like the one that you used so well.
You mean the one that caused me to win by 50 points instead of just 10?
Sure. Yes. Okay. That one.
Okay.
That card was removed, and most importantly, there was more like creative interaction between musicians and the material that they were performing. That the songs had,
which was certain, a big part of one of your contributions to the discussion.
Yes. The thing is, it's hard to talk about a game that to me feels like 90% there.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and a lot of these are kind of like choices that are really aesthetic.
Yeah.
I feel that a lot of the gameplay that Candace will choose to go with will depend on the artwork, will depend on the names of the bands or the names of the individual musicians. It's like tone, right? The artwork and some of the theme will set the tone, and then the expectations of like what you pay attention to.
I think that the song titles have always been quite funny and quite good. I thought those were always well done. There are these band drama points that you can acquire over the course of the thing. When you hire the diva, you're going to get some band drama.
Love that.
You perform in the dive bar instead of one of the clubs. You get band drama, right? Mm-hmm. All that sort of stuff is great. Well, now the band drama are these little poker chips, and on the backside of each one of them is a little flavor text, like what's causing the band drama, like the bassist slept with your girlfriend, or, you know, like...
That's so good. Like, little details like that. I'm really glad Candace is doing that. Little details like that can do so much to elevate a game. I mean, I think that's actually one of the reasons why Stationfall has been very fun, is the little details about all these characters. The fact that there's a monkey, right? That there's a monkey in Stationfall that's running around.
Chimpanzee, sir.
You're right, a chimpanzee.
Astro chimp.
Yeah. But like that invites you to just sort of make these jokes and get involved. And I always, I've mentioned it a million times on this podcast, like I love with Dead of Winter, that when you have these characters in the town, they're not just these characters. They have a name and they have an occupation. And it just like invites storytelling as you play the game. And my other example of where that works really well, surprisingly, is the game Thunder Alley, which does not appear to have any of that. But in that game, you're playing teams of race cars and everyone has a player mat.
NASCAR game.
It's like a NASCAR, like an unlicensed NASCAR game. And everyone has a player mat that has like, sort of like where you put all your cars. And if you look very closely at the player mat, all the cars have a little name attached to it. So that's cute. So that way when you're moving your car, it can be like Dorfman's going up and taking the lead. But then when you look really closely, you notice, hey, those two people have the same name. And then that person has the same name there. And all of a sudden you're creating these little narratives of like, maybe like brother and sister here or father here.
Bobby Jr. is looking to take
them. Yeah. Suddenly you start to realize these names are not just names. They actually have weird little relationships. And suddenly that can just like bring the storytelling around the game to life. So that being said, I'm really glad that Candace is adding that flavor text to those poker chips because that's just going to draw people into her game even more.
Totally. Totally agree. And I would talk about Earth, but I'm only going to give like three things about Earth, and I want to save that until after you tell us what you did at game night, because it's going to lead into one of the things I want to talk about.
So I actually played a ton of games last weekend. So basically, I was up in San Francisco doing a show, and I stayed an extra day because my friend Brendan is there. I don't know if you guys have met Brendan. Maybe during the pandemic, you may have played with him online. I think maybe Smartphone Inc. Yep. He's wonderful. Love Brendan. And, you know, he used to live down here. He was my gaming buddy down here. And we bonded over Catan and R.I.P. Klaus Tuber, who
at 70.
At 70, so who, between our last podcast, he like, I mean, Catan, that changed my life. That's how I got into this hobby.
In so many ways, the father of the modern Eurogame hobby, right?
Yeah, like it was 2014. I was at a bachelor trip. Party weekend, and my friend brought up to the Settlers of Catan. I'd never played it before. I played it. My eyes just like opened wide. I became absolutely obsessed. All I wanted to do that entire weekend was play Catan over and over and over again. And for that first year or two, I was always playing Catan. And Brendan was someone who I'd play Catan with a lot. So that's how that really got me into the hobby. Yeah. So definitely
your
like
game brain was lit up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I still, this day, I'm still always recommending Catan to people because I still think it's a tremendous game, honestly. It's a great.
Oh, yeah.
It's a super fun game and it has so much in it. So, you know, as much as we joke, like snobbery, like, oh, Catan, like the truth is, it's a great game. And no, you always have so much fun playing it.
I don't know who's snobby about Catan per se. Mm. Like, it's.
But, like, the gaming community can be snobby about it.
I mean, they can get snobby about certain things, but I'm. Like, Catan's such a clean design.
It's,
you know,
so
what I mean?
Clean. And it's so interactive, which is something we're going to talk about later, actually. Yes. But I'm not here to talk about Catan. I am here to talk about that Brendan has moved up to the Bay Area. So I was like, you know, we're going to, like, I'm going to stay an extra day and we're going to have a day of gaming. So started like around 11 or 12 or so with Brendan.
PM?
AM. Thank you for the clarification. Pacific time zone. With his coworker Cassidy, and we played, I think, 7 games over the course of the day.
Starting at midnight?
Starting at 11 a.m. after brunch.
Got it.
And I don't know if I need to go through every single one of them, or at least I can sort of give some sort of like high level views on some of them, but some of them I do want to talk about some more about.
I want to give you full license.
Full license?
To do whatever you want, okay? This is your time. Just take the space.
Well, I don't need to talk too much about the fact that we played Scout. But we played Scout.
Right.
We played a game that I had never played, but maybe you have played. It's an old Reiner Knizia game that I think has maybe been revamped. Botswana?
I've never played Botswana.
Have you played Botswana, Dimitri?
No. No.
There were like 10,000 Reiner Canizia games.
I was just about to say that. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Brendan, I think he imported this version. Maybe it was like a Japanese version, but it's basically a game of speculation. It's, you know, a classic Reiner Canizia game in that, like, category of modern art, et cetera. There's no bidding. It's just a game of there's these different animals, these adorable chunky wooden animals like giraffes and lions mm-hmm. and crocodiles. And, you know, animals like that. They're elephants, you know, your various safari type animals. And you basically, you're speculating on which group of animals is going to be worth the most points at the end of the round. And the way that that is determined is that on your turn, you place a card down, sort of like on the pile of the animal. Like if you have cards like 1 through 5, it's like, oh, I'm going to put a 1 down on the elephants. Now elephants are worth 1, and I take an animal. And then maybe Dimitri says, no, elephants are going to be worth 4, and he takes something else. And you're just taking animals and adjusting values, and then eventually at the end of the round hits, and wherever, when the round ends, whatever the value is of the animal at that moment.
It's a stock market game.
It's sort of like a stock market.
We just played a game like that, a Japanese game about a vegetable stock.
Taiwanese, vegetable stock.
Vegetable stock, exactly. Yeah. It seems like very much a similar principle. And
yeah, it was a good stock market game. Doesn't wear out its welcome. It doesn't take too long, and it's all about timing, right?
That's what this was, and this one is not over. It's a very clean, simple design, breezy. It's fun, you know. It's all about estimating who has what cards, you know, because there's only a certain number of elephant cards, only a certain number of like giraffe cards. So it's like, okay, if you put down the 0, then that means that its value can only go up. So maybe you're going to want to take a bunch of those giraffes. You know, if the 0 giraffe card went down, if someone puts down the 5, which is the highest, the value can only go down. So you're sort of just like judging. Hard to describe, very simple to play, really just like a fun, lovely, fun, lovely stock market game.
Cool.
And then along those lines, let me make a tangential mini story that's going to come back to this, which is that the day before I was in Seattle, and Seattle has some great game stores. I went to Mox Boarding House in Seattle, which had a huge selection, which was wonderful. That they had like Horseless Carriage there.
Ooh,
yeah, they had like Amsterdam and Hamburg and Marrakesh.
You had me at Horseless Carriage. That's hardcore right there.
So
when you walk into a game store in a city you've never been in, you immediately see the splatter.
Yeah, exactly. They have a wonderful selection there.
That was your Kansas City.
I was like actually sad that I already had a Horseless Carriage, because then I want to buy it there to be like, I got a Horseless Carriage. But then I went to also another Seattle game shop that I love called Blue Highway Games, which also had Horseless Carriage. And I just was like, I want to buy a game. It came over me. And so I wound up buying 3 games at Blue Highway Games. The first one I got was Findorf by Friedemann Friese.
I was about to say, is that the Friedemann Friese design? Because all of his games start with those letters. Even Power Grid, which is Funkenschlag.
Exactly. Have you even heard of Findorf before? I mean,
I've heard of it, but which one is it? The problem is that since they're all these weird F names, I have a hard time separating which one was which.
Exactly. And I hadn't even heard of it. It's sort of, I know it's been in the mix or whatever. So I saw sort of like town building, engine building, and I sort of, for some reason, it was like, I kept being drawn to it, and I looked up some quick reviews online, and they were actually very positive reviews. And I said, I'm just going to get Findorf. And then I also got a game.
That's a risky thing.
I know.
Friedemann Friese is
very hit or miss.
Super hit miss.
I know. I didn't know.
Like Power Grid, Fresh Fish, we have an absolute
deer. Oh my God, those suck so badly.
So good. I am one of the few people in our game group that really likes Fayum.
I own Fayum. I'm still like,
I'm hanging on to it.
I like it. I would like to play it again, but he is hit or miss. And I don't know why. I just was like, I feel good about this game.
Go for it.
And so I got that. I got a game called Mini Rails. Have you heard of Mini Rails? It's from like 2017.
Is it like card size rail pieces that go out? Is it that one?
It's not. It's like a.
There's like one that's like that one that was like kind of like a big city, little city that.
Yeah.
There's somebody did a card based track laying game, but okay. So
it's not that. It's actually a Taiwanese game that then eventually Tasty Minstrel released. It's something that had been on my radar for years. I never took the plunge, and I saw it tucked away. There's something about being in a game shop where you see a game that's tucked away, and you're like, I've wanted that game forever. I was like, I'm just going to get it.
Yep.
And then I also decided to randomly get Fantasy Realms. I don't know why, but I just heard it was really fun.
Okay.
So the reason why I mentioned that is because I got to play all three of those at the game day in San Francisco. And nice. So Mini Rails, I'm very interested to see what your opinion will be of it, because it's also another stock and speculation game.
Sure.
Where you are... Either you have this little map and you're either expanding a railway. On your turn, you have two actions that you can do. Expand the railway or invest in a railway. It's almost like a cube rails game. It's very simple. And there's more to it than that, but not much more to it. And we all had a blast with Mini Rails. Like, okay. We really enjoyed it a lot. So that's one. And it only takes like 20 minutes, 25 minutes.
That's a hit right there.
Yeah. So that's another one. I want to bring it to our group to see, you know, I can see either people saying, this is great. This has so much depth because there were a lot of deep decisions in it. Or people will say, this is too chaotic. It's ridiculous. But that's also, it's like 25 minutes long. Right, so yeah. Can it really be that so terrible? So wrong? So wrong that
can it be so wrong?
Could it be so wrong?
Are we doing that?
What?
That so voice?
Wrong. Yes. We could do it. It's Passover.
I think
25 minutes. What's so wrong about it?
So wrong okay? You can't spend 25 minutes with Mini Rails?
Sip, look, sip your beer. Sip your beer and play the game.
So wrong you can't call your Mini Rails once a year to say I love you?
Like, what's the... Yeah. Who are you? The king of Prussia? Is that what you is?
Don't mind Mini Rails. It'll just sit here in the corner and die while you don't call it.
Thank you so much. That really made me verklempt.
Anyway, so Mini Rails, excited to bring that to the table here. But let me talk about Findorf. I loved it.
Yeah?
I loved it. Oh. It was so fun. And it was... It doesn't break any barriers. It doesn't what's the expression? Like
it doesn't reinvent the wheel.
Reinvent the wheel.
Is that what it does?
Yes, it does not. The wheels are the same.
All right.
It was just lots of fun. It was just a very
what is it?
Okay, so it is.
it's Find Orf. It's a story about the missing composer
I would like to hear what you guys think it is. And then I'll tell you what it is.
It's like Lacrimosa. We're all looking for the composer of
what I would love is for you to rant about how great it is for another 5 minutes without telling us anything about the game. We say, well, that was Findorf. Moving on.
That was Findorf. So it's basically like the theme of it, the setting of it is that you're building up the town that Friedemann Friese grew up in. And
Little Findorf.
And essentially it's an engine builder. And you're building a little engine in hopes to gain income, and everyone has these hands of cards, and you want to basically build up enough money and resources that you can play these cards down to your tableau, and that's the cards are essentially most of your points, and the cards will give you sometimes ongoing powers or whatever, but it's sort of all done in sort of like a rondel, you know, like you can do like. You purchase your infrastructure, you do your selling stuff to raise money, yada, yada, yada. It's just, you do your actions, you move your piece down, and it's all about the timing of when do you move your piece forward, because you can keep your token where it is and do the same action over and over again, not very efficient. So, and then when you make a loop, you have to do, there's sort of like an upkeep phase. Mm-hmm. There are elements of the game that I would love to see an expansion improve. Like there's this aspect that you build houses and the houses go out on the map and there's no decision making in terms of where the houses go. There's all these spaces that you can build a house here or here or here. It doesn't matter where you build them. So I'd like an expansion that would add like a layer of decision making to that. But honestly, we all had a really fun time with Findorf. So I was really surprised by Findorf.
Ben, is this the first city building game that you've ever liked in your life?
Ben, you're a little bit of a whore for the city builder.
I love city builder. Well, this like, honestly is not a city builder.
Oh, okay. It's a faux city builder.
It's a town builder.
So it's like the mosaic of civilization games.
Bordering on a Hamlet builder.
It's just an engine building game, and the theme is that you build these houses, and that's very nice. You fill up the board with all these things, but it does not feel like a city builder. But that's okay.
Compared to Magnate, another game I don't like that you love, what would you say?
Well, they're two different games. Magnate is more of an economic game. Mm. Although this actually has an economic aspect. There is like a power grid style market, which is sort of nice.
Okay.
Magnate I like more because where you put your buildings and what type of buildings you put down has an effect on everything else. Whereas here you're just putting down buildings and has no...
Got it.
It's immaterial.
Relatively lower interaction.
Yeah, so I really enjoyed Findorf. And the other games I played, I got to play Decorum. You know about Decorum?
No.
Decorum is it's a cooperative game with a wonderful theme, which is that we are all working together to decorate a house. We are doing interior design on a house.
No, I've heard you talked about this.
Well, I think maybe we did talk about it once in passing.
Yeah, you mentioned it. It was on one of our podcasts.
Okay.
And I said, wow, that's like a fantastic theme. For a game, because you kind of are like trading off what your priorities are, and it's cooperative
exactly
that way, but it can really get on your nerves if you don't get that rug. That you need that rug.
Exactly. The headline here is it was super fun. It was really, really fun. And basically the idea is that everyone, like my private goals are that I must have a lamp on the left side of the house, or every room must be a different color. And so everyone is making adjustments to this house. And after someone makes an adjustment, you're only allowed to say, I love it, or I hate it, or meh. So it's just, it's like, it's so great because you all of a sudden step into this role of being just like a couple. We were doing the two-player game, so we were like a couple that was like fighting over the layout of the house. And I, you know, Brenda would put something down and go, I hate it, you know, I hate it, you know, and it was very, very fun.
That sounds great.
Now, yeah. Ben, I've been to your home.
Yes, you have.
And how did you achieve that? Was it a completely peaceful process? Was there a lot of fighting? Because it looks fantastic.
Well, thank you. It's been relatively peaceful. I mean, luckily, my boyfriend has a very good eye. So a lot of times, I defer to him for a lot of the visual things. He's an artist through and through, and I'm just a faux artist.
I just want everyone to know that Ben is not winking or crossing his fingers or doing anything with his face,
Ben,
other than just simply saying this real.
You are an artist.
Thank you.
Your medium is story.
Thank you.
Okay.
But my medium is not interior design.
Correct.
But
so you can have you have the artist's ear, whereas Dom has the artist's eye.
There we go. Now my only quibble, and it really is just a quibble. My only quibble with Decorum is that
I thought you were going to say my only quibble with Dom.
My only quibble with Dom. Let's just air it all out, guys.
Deep cleansing breath and out.
By the way, Dom in Russian means house.
Oh,
Dom in English means something else.
That's
continue.
Right. So the issue that my only quibble with Decorum, and there's a quibble I think I mentioned last time, is that I don't like the way the game looks. And that's only a quibble in this situation where when you have a game about design and making a house look a certain way, I wish that the components were, it's hard to describe what they look like, but I really wish that at the end you look at the house and you say, now that's a house, you know, or like that looks like a room.
Right.
And I think that probably for maybe usability, the visuals are really simple. And I wish it felt like when you paint a room, it looks like the room really is like a green room or something, you know?
Look, you know me, I'm not really into the decor of a game, but if the decor of the game is in a game called Decor, I think the decor matters.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. This is one of those specific things where I was like, you know what? If the game is all about how a room looks, I think you got to make sure everything looks like a real room.
There are some games where the look of it really, really matters. I mean, we were playing Tricarion just a week ago. the look of that game really matters.
Yeah.
Right? Because you're selling a whole period, a whole mm-hmm. essence, a whole atmosphere. And it really is important in that game. So,
Shipyard.
As much as Shipyard very much is a great look to it, which I think maybe why people were complaining about the changing what was already a really good look.
Yes.
Which I get. What I think of when I think of that is modern art.
Yeah.
Modern art has gone through several iterations, but a lot of the criticism people get is like, how can you criticize that game?
Mm-hmm.
The game is a masterpiece. It's so simple. It's so amazing. But when you put up those janky looking cards of modern art that are
from like the 90s,
kind of horrible, you know, that could pull people out the same way it could in decor, which is why
decorum, by the way.
Decorum, beg your pardon. Which is why one of those things that they keep putting out these specialty editions of modern art. Mm-hmm. Like there's an Old Masters modern art. There is a Japanese modern art and all that sort of stuff. And as much as I hate shelling out money for organizers on Etsy and this and that and the other thing, I must say that I do from time to time Jones and covet mm-hmm. those specialty editions of modern art because I think it would make the game better because you're bidding on things that look like they have more intrinsic value than the game you're playing.
Absolutely. I think that's like there's sometimes, you know, I used to always be like, oh, I don't care about art, but I think art really can be very important in terms of like the overall gaming experience. And I have the last game that I'm going to mention where I think the art actually is a big draw in it is I finally got to play in person Maglev Metro, which is designed by Ted Alsbach. And that is a subway building game. And one, probably the coolest thing about it, and something I would love to see see that in future designs, is that you're building subway tracks with hexes, and the hexes are all transparent. But your subway line is on them. So like if you're the red player, you have like a red line. It looks like a real subway map when you put them all together. And the reason why they are transparent is that the way that the lines have been drawn is that if you stack the red track over the blue track over the green track, they all line up adjacent to each other. They're not stacked on. Yeah. So they're not, when you look through the transparencies, it looks like three colors going side by side as opposed to a stack all on top of each other. So it looks like a real subway map. It is the most subway mappy looking subway game there is.
Oh, that's amazing.
It's so amazing to look at. And you know, it's a very fun game with a lot of interesting decisions. It's not the subway game that I necessarily am looking for because It's a game about efficiency, which is cool. But I think what was missing for me was an economic quality.
Yeah. 1840 Vienna Tramways is such a, is it 40?
Yeah, 40.
Yeah, it's such a good game as far as to get that urban kind of mm-hmm. tram experience. I think that's just an amazing game.
Yeah, and on the underground is my favorite subway game because that one you're building out a network, and there you have this one passenger who, based on how you build the network, the passenger is going to go this way or that way. And that's sort of what I was hoping more from with Maglev Metro, but it was still very fun. I'm still on the quest for the perfect, like the City Builder, I'm looking for the perfect subway game. There's a new one that's actually on Kickstarter called Terminus that looks very, very, very intriguing.
I was looking at that too.
Did you look at that? What did you think about it?
I think looking at it, for me, the jury is out, but it looks like it's got enough interesting aspects to it. It looks like it looks closest to Age of Steam of any of the kind mm-hmm. of games we play, which is high marks right there. It's kind of interesting. It looks a little more Euro-y than 18XX in terms mm-hmm. of its design philosophy and where it comes from. I'm dying to try it.
Yeah, my only concern, it looks like a great game. It looks super fun. There's like a rondel. There's an economic aspect. My only concern is it feels like when you're building that subway system and you make this really cool map, my only concern is that you're just building a subway system and there doesn't seem to be An aspect of the game where you're concerned about how people are getting from point A to point B, you know, and that's what I love about a subway game is how do you actually build an infrastructure and then people are just using it.
It seems to be much more of a standard Euro action economy game, because what it is you have this huge rondel in the middle of the board. And you are going to only everyone's going to go around the rondel like 9 times or something, and the game is over, something along those lines. And you're going to have a limited number of actions that you're going to be able to take, and how well do you use those actions to do the things that you want to do is kind of what it is.
Building a subway with no concern about how people will actually be using it. You've just described our subway in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, actually. Yeah, I know.
And as much as or I DC. Love the subway, and as much as I love the idea of the subway, when I was growing up in Kyiv, we had the same thing. We had like a single line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like a straight line subway where it goes.
I'm not sure if
you want to go there, great.
The subway is expanding in Los Angeles. It's doing pretty well.
It's done
well
a lot of
right
stuff
now.
Actually for Culver City. Yes. I mean, and all this, all sorts of development because of it. But
I take the subway into downtown now, and really? now that the Crenshaw line is open, I can take it down to the depth of Crenshaw all the way basically almost to the airport now.
Yeah, wow. All of those are streetcars. You know, and those are great. Well, you know, the Expo line.
No, a lot of them are L's. A lot of sections are L's. They're elevated.
Sure. But a subway that goes underground, they're building one to Westwood. And no one goes to Westwood anymore.
Until
you never know.
Until you build it.
Build it and they will come.
They will come.
Well, I mean, they've been working through Wilshire forever. You know, the thing, there was a video game. I don't know if you ever played it, called Mini Metro. It was like a browser-based game, and now I think it's a full-fledged game that you can like download on the Switch. Huh. And the idea of it is that you are building subway tracks, and as you build the subway tracks, passengers start to pop up in these different areas. And so you have to... If the passengers wait too long, you lose the game. Like a clock starts to tick down, and you got to service the passengers. So you got to either build to them, and not only do you have to build to them, the subway actually has to get to them. So then you're starting to think like, oh gosh, my subway line is getting too long. So by the time my subway car is all the way on the west side, the people on the east side are waiting too long. So you got to add another car to it, or maybe add another line, and you start building this thing and this crushing demand of people needing to get places.
This was an iOS game, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah, I used to play that
and
all the time.
It was so fun, but I'm still looking for a subway game that captures that experience. I don't know if it's fair to me to be like upset at Maglev Metro that it doesn't do that, because it right. why should we punish a game because it doesn't do something that I want to do?
Yeah.
So, but
original SimCity, by the way, did a great job. Like building subways in SimCity is one of my favorite things in the world, and just watching how the neighborhood changes.
Yes. Just overnight. And so like on the underground, one of the reasons why I really like it, I think it's because there is like this AI aspect that you do your turn and then you hand it over to the game, and the game says, okay, this passenger wants to go this place. And so they hop on the train and they move around, and then, oh no, you weren't expecting it. They made a transfer to this other line. And like, it's funny. It's interesting to see which lines get used over and over and over again by the AI, and then trying to like capitalize off that. It feels like a living, breathing subway system. And I want a game that really leans into that. That being said, Maglev Metro, I enjoyed it.
The graphic interpretation of it sounds amazing. It
reminds me of, just for that alone.
It was one of the, like, okay, we're all three of us are writers, right? We go down research rabbit holes. At one point in the last year, I went down an internet rabbit hole and saw a article online. I could not find it if I tried to right now, but it was by a designer of subway maps who was going over the history of the New York subway map and how it has evolved.
I read that same article. It's amazing.
It was incredible.
I would love to read
that. The decisions that they go into, how you're trying to make clarity match with utility and artistry, and it was incredible.
Yeah, because the whole point is like you only have 90-degree angles or 60-degree angles or straight lines, and you're not trying to match the topography. If you match it too closely, it's confusing. If you don't match it closely enough that then where you're going.
The stops have to be perfectly geographically. Everything else can be a representation. But how do you do that with 10 different lines crossing the same general area? It's amazing.
Yeah, I think that subway games have an ability to explore transportation in a way that train games don't. Train games are more sort of, they can be like, those are bigger, that's about moving like over long distances. But the idea of a closed area with people who need to be places right this moment is like a really exciting space to explore.
I'm probably the only person here who studied railway maps, as a kid. Everyone has studied subway maps.
True.
It's a much more instinctive, we bring many more expectations to a subway, what a subway game should look like and how it should behave.
And there's a lot of potential playing with the idea that like if you build it, they will come. Like you build a subway line and that's great. People will use it. And then actually also the demand goes up. And now how do you service now all these people that want to use the subway and how do you build out from there? And I love the idea that you're sort of like in the game Mini Metro, you are just falling into a deeper and deeper hole in trying to create this transportation. And like you make a line and it seems like, oh, this is a wonderful subway line that I just made. And then you realize all of its flaws as you start to, as the demand crushes it. And I would love a game that does that. Maglev Metro does not do that, but Maglev Metro does a very interesting game in terms of efficiency. And there are these, it's a micro turn kind of game. Like you spend your turn, like I'm loading up the passengers this turn and now I'm turning my train around, and then you wait for the next person. But it's an interesting game. I'm on the cusp. If I find it for a good price, maybe I'll get it. But for right now, not getting it.
On the Underground, I think is fantastic.
It's so fun.
You taught it to me. We don't play it, I think, because it's a little too fun.
brought it around.
Tom,
recently.
Have you played it?
Ben has brought it out three times at my game night, and not one of those times did I end up playing it with him. The problem, of course, being that Ben is a game teacher,
and so are you.
Not really. I give the Tom teach, but
but does Ben have a teach named after him? Good. No.
Deep cleansing breath in and out.
For the record, on the Underground, there's two new maps coming out that I backed on Kickstarter, and hopefully they'll be. I don't know when they're arriving, but I'll
bring it, and I would like to play this game.
I think you'll. It's actually on the Underground. I recommend that. That's one of those games I recommend to everyone. Because
for the vast majority of times, my taste and yours mesh quite well, and I would.
I think you will like it. Because I found that on the Underground, people who don't game very much can play it. It's very accessible, but people who do game can find actually a lot of depth in it, more depth than you would expect, and it's very fun.
Just a note that I just read this morning, because when we played, the passenger was Meghan Markle.
Yes, because we played the London map.
Yes, Meghan Markle, and I just found out that Harry and she are not going to be allowed on the balcony for the coronation.
Wow, they will literally be on the Underground.
Harry was just in England, and his dad couldn't find time in the schedule to meet with him.
Yeah.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah.
Sounds like a great family dynamic happening there.
Oh, it's
well, the English royal family has never had any kind of infighting or alienation. The kids always love Papa. I know that from Shakespeare.
As they say in London, that's so Vanderpump.
It is.
It is.
Actually, it's more like Succession, but that's fine.
Yeah, a little bit. I guess we might as well get to Earth, which is to say,
let's get to Earth.
I didn't play it. I saw it being played. It looks gorgeous. It certainly, it cuts a mean table. It makes a mean table space.
Okay.
It looks beautiful. And people playing the game said it is good. It is kind of Wingspan version 2.0. It is a better, more in-depth Wingspan.
Do you know what is Earth?
Oh, no. Let's talk about Earth for another 10 minutes without actually describing what it is. Stop.
Earth Day.
And then say Earth.
Earth Day is around the corner.
It's a tableau builder where you're getting cards and you're laying cards out in your own 4x4 grid. The cards give you actions and abilities to take. So you're going to grow, you're going to plant soil, you're going to grow sprouts, you're going to put, you know, grow trees, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of an ecological game. Mm. Essentially what it is.
Okay.
The main comment that I heard from several people is that gorgeous, well-designed, it is going to be a very popular game, but it is multiplayer solitaire. Mm-hmm. It is multiplayer solitaire. And Matt said, you know, it's a little unfortunate because there is definitely a design trend that is going on right now that has been going on for a while now, but certainly toward more of those multiplayer solitaire kind of experiences. And realize the term multiplayer solitaire goes way back to the beginning of the Euro hobby. It was what Ameritrash gamers or American style gamers would say about Euro games. They would say, mm-hmm. there's almost no interaction. It is basically multiplayer solitaire, when it wasn't. Catan is in no way multiplayer solitaire. It is a trading game. You have to trade resources mm-hmm. in order to build the things you want to do. It is very in your face. It is very
interactive
and heavily so. Early games like El Grande, and we just mentioned Modern Art. Modern mm-hmm. Art is a bidding game. Bidding games are tremendously interactive.
All the 18XX games are
hugely
are deeply interactive.
Though that comes from the American side of the ledger, right?
Is it? I don't know. I mean, I know Francis Tresham. Was he American or is he British? I guess it doesn't matter. But
he predates the Euro games movement,
right?
And his games were popular during the same period. Like 1830 mm-hmm. was played concurrently with his other design, Civilization, and all of those yeah. games. So it's definitely on the pre-Euro style. It's yeah. not a Euro style game.
Definitely not.
And it kind of got me thinking because these games are getting more something, but I'm not sure multiplayer solitaire is the best way to describe it. First of all, because that term is a little tainted. And when I started thinking about it, I realized what it is for me is there is a difference between a game and a puzzle. And a lot of games have both aspects in them to some degree. But the games that we love are the ones that have the puzzle as a component of the game, but not the dominant component of the mm-hmm. game. And when we say this game's a little too multiplayer solitaire, a lot of times what we're saying is that the game is mostly puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
Which I mean by that, if you get a jigsaw puzzle out, it is largely a solitary experience, right? I mean, mm-hmm. listen, you and I can do a puzzle together, but how much togetherness is there really? We're each searching a pile of pieces, trying to find something that goes with another one. And every once in a while, I'll see a piece that's on your side of the puzzle.
Well, that's philosophical, because there are people who will probably say, oh, every week I do a puzzle with my husband, or I do it, or sure. like my family, we get together and do a puzzle. So, you know, people might say, actually, it's a joint activity. I know what you're saying, but I'm saying that it could be interpreted actually right. as a very together
a shared
kind of thing.
Activity versus an interactive activity.
Okay.
Right? You get what I'm saying there?
Yeah.
Right? So a shared activity is something like I can read a book with my spouse. We're reading two different books, but we're having a shared activity. Mm-hmm. We're doing something, you know, kind of together.
Right.
Right? Is very, very different than something in which the thing that I do is going to change, impact, challenge what you're doing, which is much more a game experience, right? A game experience in the classical term is that we are competing, right? There's a mm-hmm. level of competition in it to some degree, though there are co-ops, and we've broadened the definition to a large degree. But to some extent, a game is an activity in which the interaction is complex, robust, and hard to predict from one person to another because of the interaction and actions of people. Whereas a puzzle is can be a shared experience, mm-hmm. but generally doesn't have that high level of interactivity.
So My question to you is a question that my history professor used to always ask. He always said, you always have to ask this question in a term paper.
Yeah.
He would always say, so what?
Yeah.
So what?
The so what of it is that that we need to be looking at our games from this perspective. I think it's useful to look at our games from this perspective because there are people that there are people that have played Earth and say, look, it's gorgeous. It's just not for me. Why is it not for you? It's not for you because the things that I do in the game and the things that you do in the game have very little to do with each other.
So when you're saying that there's this trend now, or you feel there's a trend towards more puzzle forward games.
Yes.
Now, is this bothering you?
Well, it is in the sense that, I think that there have been many trends since I started heavy into this hobby, 25 years ago, maybe even more now, where I've seen things come and go, and the things can be as simple as a mechanism becomes super popular, mm-hmm. and for a while that's all we're doing, right? Card drafting, set collection, hand management games became super, super popular, and everything was that for a while, and that kind of waned. Right now, we're having a lot of games that are very puzzly, and
what do you want? What is it about the puzzliness that is sort of hitting you wrong, or that you're not as much in favor of? Like, what is it why would you want more? And I'm not challenging, I'm just curious.
No. Yeah.
What would you want? Why would you lean more towards something that's more game forward than something that's more puzzle forward?
Because for me, a puzzle forward game is a little bit, look at me. It's a little bit, look at this neat little clockwork that I have here and focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a game forward game is, look at what you did. Look at what you did. Look at what you have done to mess me up. And now I have to reconsider everything in terms of my decisions. Paul last night in Shipyard.
Oh, this is Paul's fault. I already could tell. This is all Paul's fault.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, what Paul does is throw a chimp wrench into what you're playing. So you never know when Paul is going to come over and just kick your sandcastle apart, or do something that would prevent you from doing something beautiful and elegant and like really neat and cool.
Mm-hmm. And yet what happened last night was that Paul found himself on the receiving end of that again and again and again. His game
He loves that, actually, by the way.
He
cherishes those moments.
He's very funny when that happens.
He said, I don't like this game. And I said, really? I thought you'd love this game. He said, oh, don't misunderstand me. I like Shipyard. I don't like this game tonight.
That's what happened with Brick and Mortar when we played with him, right? He was just getting trounced.
Sure. And one of the things that really frustrated him was that we weren't like really trying to attack him. It just happened that the sum total of our puzzle solving, collective puzzle solving, meant that was all directed by coincidence at him.
He had developed a terrible block of businesses in our town, and you know what? Unfortunately, they were just not selling well, and he was just getting buried by his own bad business instincts.
Paul, the invisible hand of the market, is going to tell you exactly what you have, and sometimes it's going to slap you right in that face.
Actually, I have Paul right here, and I'm going to ask him to come out and defend himself.
But he was invited to come on today, and he declined. It's his own fault. Okay, let's let him have it. No,
so a game forward thing you feel like is it's more about like what you are doing, as opposed to puzzle forward is more about look what I'm doing,
or more like look what the game is doing. Mm-hmm. Look at it's like, ooh, look at that. That's really neat. There are and by the way, there are tons of games that are very puzzle feeling, and yet they're totally games. Ricochet Robots is one of my absolute favorite games.
What's that?
It is 100% a puzzle. That's all the game is. It is figure out how to get these robots to these places following this very simple rule set in the fewest moves possible. Mm-hmm. It becomes a game the moment everybody, the moment you flip over the new thing and you figure out where everyone has to go, because the rule of the game is whoever calls out a number first has locked down that number, and other people can come up with their own solutions, but it is a race to get to that.
Well,
so you could play that as a puzzle where you're simply doing it yourself, and maybe you're timing yourself, maybe you're trying to get the lowest result or whatever, but the fact that everybody is racing against one another to get that time gives it the feeling of a game, even though what it really is just a puzzle.
So interestingly, you know, maybe the reason why that comes off as like a game, because they're sort of all involved, there's a race. There are a lot of games that really are, you're doing your own thing for the whole game, but you're really racing against everyone else. So I think of Roll for the Galaxy. One could say Race for the Galaxy. I don't have enough experience with Race for the Galaxy, but I used to own Roll for the Galaxy. And you're sitting there and you're rolling and you're doing your own thing on your board, setting up, creating your own tableau. And you basically want to be the first to hit the scoring. Like you want to get enough of those points, or there was another scoring thing.
Sure.
And in that game, that's a race too. Like it all is about like, you just need to hit that. You need to get to where you need to be before everyone else, much like Ricochet Robots. However, it reads as much more, I guess you could say, puzzle forward, since we're not saying multiplayer solitaire. And I wonder why. Is it because Ricochet Robots has like, there's like a real economy of rules, and so therefore the race element really feels more prominent than maybe in Roll for the Galaxy?
Well, first of all, it's a real time game, and real time is always amps up that pressure, right? That there's just a atmosphere and a feeling of it. But I would say like Race for the Galaxy, which I love very much, much more than Roll for the Galaxy, has a lot of game to it in the sense that I have to choose one of these six things that I can do. I'm either going to try and get a planet or develop a development card or trade or so on and so forth. Those are the things I'm going to do. The card I play, other people are going to be able to take some advantage of the card that I played. And if I can figure out what you and you are going to do, and I know for sure that the thing I have to do, somebody else also has to do, I can choose to do something else and thereby get an advantage. That is very much a game element. That is not a puzzle element at all.
I think you put your finger on the difference that I think is very important between competitive and interactive.
Yes.
Ricochet Robots is a very competitive game.
Yes.
Because you're trying to minimize the moves.
Correct.
In your head. But it's not interactive. There's nothing.
At all.
Except, right. You know, if you remember, Paul tried to make it interactive once by just simply jumping in and naming a time and then trying to come up a number.
He would say 20 right off the bat, and then you have 30 seconds, and he was basically...
Which is his own way of not very interactive.
It's
the difference for me between figure skating and hockey.
Yeah.
Figure skating is very competitive.
Yes. But it's also a solo activity.
Yeah. It's not interactive.
Or pair.
So I don't think the competition angle is really what's at heart here.
It's the interactive.
You want the interactivity. Is that what you're saying?
I actually have an answer for why games are less interactive now.
Go for it.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about two splatters.
I was going to say, I'm going to let you say it. I was going to bring up a splatter.
I think splatters on both our minds. What's your splatter?
I was going to say, where does Horseless Carriage, which I still have not
exactly
played, fall into
exactly
this?
The history of splatters, by the way, going all the way back,
is to go from highly interactive to less so.
Absolutely not. Not true.
Absolutely so, because Horseless Carriage has your puzzle board where nothing that Paul can do. Maybe he can lean over and just flip over my factory.
Yeah,
right.
Almost 20 years ago, Antiquity has the exact same thing.
You just
what
got
I'm
Tom.
Thinking of is
saying it's, what you're seeing as a trend is not a
what
trend.
I want to compare to Horseless Carriage is a different game from 20 years ago, Indonesia. Everything
much more recent, but okay.
All say again.
That's
Not 20 years ago, but go ahead.
Just a small ombudsman.
2005, moment. 18 years ago. I apologize, although it might be 20.
Either way.
Tom, you're looking it up?
Yeah.
I'm not being competitive right now. I'm just being interactive. I want you to
very interactive about this very important point.
Indonesia came two games later in 2005.
18 years. 18 years. 18, 20, you know, drinking age versus age of consent.
Indonesia is about to go to college.
Sure. Yes. Okay. So Indonesia, the puzzle of Indonesia is interactive. Your factory floor, where you actually make the car, in horse's carriage, is entirely your design. Mm-hmm. The puzzle of the map of Indonesia, where do I place my plantations? Where do I place my oil, my rice, my other production? How do I grow them? Right? They're also producing.
Yeah.
Just like my factory in horse's carriage.
Yep.
I'm the only person responsible for the factory. Whereas in Indonesia, everybody is interacting, not just competing to make the best possible factory, but interacting with each other, getting into each other's way.
Yeah.
To solve the puzzle of how you grow your tropical factories.
Yeah.
You know, your production zones.
Your companies.
Your shipping, and then merging them. How long does Indonesia take to play?
3 to 5 hours.
How long does horseless carriage take to play?
2 to 3 hours.
Yes. I think that's the answer, Tom.
Well, except that
Dmitry cross-examination.
No, I get it. The only problem is that before Indonesia came antiquity, in which you have your own player board where you are making your perfect city, and you can get another city and make your own perfect city there too. There is a shared board, but there is a personal board, just like there is in. Let me please.
Sure.
Before that, before that was roads and boats. And roads and boats, if you look at the maps that they suggest you play with, the vast majority of them are designed to have 80-90% of the game be a puzzle experience.
That's a great example, Roads and Boats.
Right?
Because it can be actually 100% a solo game.
Correct.
But it can also be the other, exact opposite.
I'm sorry.
No, Roads and Boats can be a deeply solo game. You're just in your corner and you're building up your puzzle and you're literally barely interact with anyone except for maybe as you build this wonder. But then it can all flip on its head and become like deeply, deeply, deeply interactive, which is kind of amazing that it can do that.
And if Roads and Boats takes 5 hours, you've gone exceptionally fast. If Antiquity takes only 4 hours, oh my goodness, how did you end it that quickly? And I will say that going right up to the modern day, Food Chain Magnate, the organization of your corporate structure and putting people in the jobs is a puzzle. There is a puzzle aspect to the game. They've always had it. Not every single game has it. Great Zimbabwe and Indonesia don't have it, but all of the others do.
That's the reason that I picked those two splatters, Tom.
Got it.
My thesis here is that games that are less interactive and more puzzly play faster. Play in about half the time, and I'll give you three reasons for that.
Okay.
Okay. One, when you have your own player board, people can take their actions simultaneously. You cannot simultaneously place plantations on the Indonesia map, but you can simultaneously place car-making machines on your factory floor in horse's carriage.
Mm.
Number two, you can plan your actions ahead of time much more than on your own board, because Paul is not going to, whatever, destroy your plan with his move. You can destroy your plan with your move, but you can do basically what you want, plan it ahead of time. One of the complaints about Tuletum is AP, right? Because there's a lot of interactivity. And finally, Tom, I'm going to put on my wizard hat right now. I'm going to put on my mortar board and my academic road, and I'm going to take a deep dive into some voodoo, into some academic voodoo.
Okay.
I'm going to bring up Claude Shannon. Claude Shannon is probably the scientist who affected our lives more than anybody else in the 20th century.
He invented Viagra.
Okay. He's actually why everyone went digital. He's why computers are digital, why movies are digital, why devices are digital, why phones are digital. He proved mathematically that anytime you convey information, anytime you communicate, you generate noise. You can't help it because it's related to entropy. Anytime I communicate information to you, I generate noise. Just like anytime I transfer heat or transfer energy, actually, I generate heat. I generate entropy. Noise and entropy are the same thing. This is why we do everything digitally, because zero and one is the minimum amount of information that I can convey, and it generates the minimum amount of noise. When I am looking down on my player board, I'm not communicating. I'm not conveying information. I am just solving a puzzle. I'm doing things on my own. When multiple players interactively do something on the same board, there's a ton of communication and a ton of noise. And noise generates confusion.
So, I'm now ready to jump in on this because, again, we're talking a lot about, okay, so when you're playing, when you're doing, you're sort of doing basically multiplayer, so solitaire,
right?
You're not talking as much. When you're doing, when as an interactive game, you're talking more. So again, I still am asking, so what? Right? Like what? Like so what?
So what is that?
I don't
to play Indonesia.
Yeah.
To play the classic interactive American games takes a day.
But
so, Dune, for example, I love Dune. I think
that's
Dune
not very interactive, though. I'm just kidding. Just kidding, everyone. Just kidding. Wow.
No, there. No, I mean, the problem is that you're not exactly right. They're tremendously interactive game, incredibly interactive game, plays in a heartbeat. There is not a one-to-one relationship between length of the game and amount of interaction. There just isn't.
I'm gonna bring up.
I want Ben to continue.
I guess
his point,
I think
though.
I think what I'm trying to get at here is like, what is this saying about what we like to do when we gather to play games?
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to get at. It's like. Like, okay, so if we all play a game together and like we're just doing a puzzle together, some people might say like, yes, that's great. Some people say that's like, you know, I want to be interacting with my friends. So it's like, I think what it comes down to is how we view our social interactions and how we want to express our play and what do we value out of that? You know, and I think it seems like I think we're all pretty aligned that we'd like interactivity because we get to talk with each other, we get to joke with each other, and it adds just another dimension to the gameplay of like I don't have to be thinking just not only what I'm doing, I really have to get into other people's minds. And that's I think something that we enjoy that thing. Some people may not want to get into people's minds.
I understand that. Yeah. But for me for sure, the reason is that no game designer has ever come up with a game that is as interesting a puzzle to solve as you are, Ben. As you are, Dimitri.
Wow.
I would rather play the puzzle of figuring out what you're going to do,
right.
you gentlemen, and figure out how to counter-program that, how to play against that, how to use those advantages with me and against me and so on and so forth. Like, I don't want to invite you guys over to all sit down and read a book together. Mm-hmm. I think that actually sounds like a wonderful activity. I wouldn't mind doing that separately, but that's not primarily what I want to do. And I think it kind of goes back to Agricola for me, weirdly, because Agricola was one of the earliest games, one of the first big hits where you have an individual player board. Prior to that, almost everything was on one big board, right? And then we became to have this small little player board. And then you had things like Hansa Titanica, which would come, which had a very small player board, but it was increasingly important in terms of how you played that little mini game, that little puzzle part of mm-hmm. the game. And listen, there are games that do a great job of mixing those. I think most splatters do a really good job of making sure that there is a puzzle aspect to the game, but that it doesn't overwhelm the whole thing. And maybe yeah. Horse's Carriage might be too far the other way. Pipeline is a great game where there is a little puzzle that you have to solve yourself of putting these pipes together in a certain order, but that's not the meat of the game. The meat of the game is out here on the central board where we're fighting it out.
I think for me, I don't necessarily need to get into people's heads. I think that's always, when the game offers that, it's always great. I think for me, what I'd like when I'm gaming with people is I like to there always to be like lively table conversation. I like when there's joking. I like when there's just like, I like when the game is a vehicle to really fun social interaction. And that doesn't necessarily have to mean, okay, what is Dimitri thinking? It's more just like, I want to be able to, you know, use this as a way to have like social fun. And so interestingly,
Ben, just ask. Just ask. I'll tell you. But go on.
So on Monday, I played Atiwa with two of my friends. Atiwa would probably fall into the category of maybe being like puzzle forward. It's not terribly interactive. You know, you're doing worker placement, but it's, you know, it's largely head down, face down, whatever, everything down. And all your pieces are, you have two boards. I mean, like all your pieces are coming from here, going to there. You actually, one board and you have a tableau. But it was so much fun. And the game actually wound up taking, I think, 3.5 hours, which is crazy for Atiwa. But the reason why it took so long is because we were all joking with each other and joking about each other's tableaus and joking about like how my friend Sylvie had like a million bats that she couldn't control and she'd have to kill bats, you know? And you know, it was an amazing time because we were really focused on interacting with each other. And I think that like sometimes with games, it's also up to the players. And like players, there's ways to interact even in those puzzle forward games. I think maybe we're talking about, well, the games that we're talking about that we really like are the ones that don't give us the option to recede. Like that they're the games that really force us to interact no matter what. Because Atiwa, you can just play very quietly, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that like games that encourage us to really interact are going to be the ones that we resonate with the most. Mm-hmm. I will also say that in terms of getting into people's heads, I think if you play certain games over and over and over again, and you really get to understand the games and like everything that's going on, that is actually emergent play. You know, if I played Atiwa like 30 times with you, Tom, mm-hmm. I would get to a point where I'd be like, oh, Tom took that terrain, which means he's probably going to do this, so I should come up with a counter, you know? So I think a lot of those multiplayer solitaire games can have that emergent, you know, get into each other's heads, but we just don't play these games enough to really get to that place.
I mean, kind of, but in reality, a lot of the games I talk about when I say this is the puzzle aspect of the game and this is the game aspect of the game. The game aspect of the game already is one of those things where the interactions are largely emergent. They're mm-hmm. not, because Euro games are famously not punch you in the nose and bloody you. No, it's mm-hmm. I'm simply taking the build fences action.
Right.
Now, did that wound you far more than me invading you with my armies? Yes, it did. It crushed all of your hopes and dreams.
Yeah.
And your farm is going to fail now. It is huge, but it is something that is a much more indirect.
Yeah, totally indirect. Yeah. But I think that, like, again, certain games, you know, if I play Agricola just casually with some friends, it's like, oh, I want that. Oh, someone took it. Okay, I got to pivot. But like if you're playing like on a high level, you're thinking, what do they need? What is their farm looking like right now? What can I like think about in terms of like, I want that spot, but maybe I can let it ride for a round because I don't think they're going to use that. Like, you can still get into people's heads with those multiplayer solo games, but I don't think that's at the forefront necessarily. So yeah. I guess I just don't want to sell those games short.
I would listen. No, I don't mean to sell them short. I really mean to say that a lot of us in our group have developed a fairly similar taste in this aspect, in the aspect that we tend to prefer these. And I think it's, I think I'm not trying to denigrate anybody else's, I'm not trying to yuck anybody's yum.
Right.
But I am trying to stand up and say, I think that these games work really well for us, and there should be more of those. And I think maybe to some degree, there are that the pace of the trend of design might be going away from something that is core, and we're going to miss a little bit.
Do you think it's harder to design those really interactive games because they might be more fragile?
Yeah, not just fragile. Jennifer talks about how game mechanisms are a technology.
Yep.
One of the things that happens to cars, for example, is they get much more complicated with time.
Yep.
I think the same thing happens to game mechanisms. I think it's much easier to make a newer game more complicated because you're building on something, and it's easier to add an element. Like expansions, that's what expansions are.
Yep.
In our play of Tricarion.
Tricarion,
a week ago, Tom, they took rule-breaking cards and put them on the market, on the black market, on the night market, whereas before, I think, there were just...
The Dark Alley.
And I think before, that was just another way of getting resources that you might need before the expansion.
Yeah.
That's a complication. That's a meta. Now you're competing not for something you need, but for something that might break, you know, a rule later on that you anticipate needing.
Mm-hmm.
Much more complex, right? And as games get more complicated, they get longer to play. They are more demanding of time. And the way to reduce the time demand is to make them less interactive. So everybody can play at once, everybody can play ahead, and there's less noise, there's less confusion.
Or to increase the elegance and make them less complicated while maintaining their complexity through their interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what we want, right?
Yes.
Sure. That's a perfectly valid and terrific way to go. But elegance, remember, you remember the discussion about elegance.
It is the hardest thing to order on the menu because you can't be sure you're going to get
elegance. Yeah. Do you remember what game you were reviewing when you discussed elegance?
What game were I?
Carnegie. You were reviewing Carnegie.
Carnegie.
Carnegie. Because I'm thinking horses, carriage, car.
You know he's Scottish, right? Carnegie.
Okay, the Astors. Okay, so if you remember, I loved Carnegie. Ben,
I think I put it number one.
Yeah, and so did Paul, right? Tom, what was Matt's big complaint about Carnegie?
The most recent complaint was the map.
In other words, yes. Matt, who says that he wants interaction, right? His biggest complaint about Carnegie is the map, is the shared map.
But his issue is that he felt like he was forced to prioritize building a route across the country versus the other strategies.
And a relatively particular route. What he's saying is, what he said, not to put words in his mouth, but what he said was pretty clear, which I agree with, is that the central aspect of the game, it may have a problem or two in it, in that there are very few solutions.
I mean, I don't know that problem, for the record.
But it's interactive. And it's people competing for the same goal. This is what you want, and yet this is what Matt says.
But I'm not sure that's what Matt necessarily wants. I don't know. I mean, I think Matt, he does, he's solo gamer. He does mode.
But he
does, so I don't know.
He
I don't
say
know
with
his...
Earth. He did say with Earth specifically, which brought this conversation on, that, you know, that I wish that there were that this design trend toward multiplayer solitaire wasn't what was not the main was not a main thing that is a trend.
You know, here's the thing ultimately for me is that if I am going to be playing a game that is more multiplayer solitaire, I want that puzzle that I'm doing to be amazing. I want it to be so fun that I'm just like bursting with joy. And like, that's how I felt about Praga Caput Regni. There are some interactions there on the board, but I have so much fun with that puzzle, the puzzle of that game. I don't care. I'm joyous. And then usually if I'm joyous, I'm usually just like talking. I'm usually saying, oh my God, oh, that's a disaster. I'm all messed up or whatever. And then I'm talking to Dimitri maybe, and Dimitri's also maybe going through it. And then we are actually kind of all going through this shared misery of everything going wrong. But I think if the multiplayer solo is like a little meh, then you're kind of left with nothing. Then you just sort of have like you're doing a puzzle in front of you that's like, it's fine. But then you're not like, there's nothing to talk about with people. So then you're just sort of like having a nice, pleasant, but forgettable experience.
Yeah. I'll list three games that have a strong similarity, but a difference in this regard. And those are the card-based, tag-based games of Mosaic, Ark Nova, and Terraforming Mars.
Okay.
All three of them are very similar in a lot of ways. The primary mechanism of the game is you are getting, drafting, buying cards that are tag-based. You're looking for synergies within that in order to put pieces on a map in order to maximize your score. The difference is that Ark Nova, of the three, my favorite theme by far, by a country mile,
it's wonderful.
The zoo and the preservation of animals and all that sort of stuff. If everything else were the same, I would play Ark Nova every single time, and I would almost never touch the other games.
Mm-hmm.
But
Tom, the theme of Ark Nova is not running a zoo. It's actually organizational priorities.
I'm going to ignore Dimitri because the theme of the zoo game is to get a zoo that is both going to bring in crowds but also have a strong stance toward conservation and the preservation of
species. You could so easily skin that to be a university or
either way.
Or
Dimitri is just trying to mess with people.
This is what
I'm trying to be interactive.
I'm about to say he's interacting. Yes. Well, he's making digital noise.
The thing is a log noise, but
theme-wise, on a digital platform.
Theme-wise, look, I love myself a good space game, especially a semi-realistic. In the future, we could be developing Mars this way.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love a good civilization game. I love that. But Ark Nova's got an amazing theme, and I would play that every single time, except for one factor. There is no central map. There is no central board that we're fighting it out on. We are building things on our own little player maps.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. We're building on our player maps. And the other two games, we are collecting cards, putting cards into sets, and almost always, a lot of that interaction is in order to put things on a central board in which, when I take this, you can no longer take this. When I put this here, it has huge implications for you and your game. In the case of Mosaic, it is toward area scorings, region scorings, where the person with the most in this region, area majority, is going to heavily interactive game, heavily gamified.
But you can also do Mosaic. Like, it's, you can also kind of have like a solo experience with Mosaic. You know,
you can a little bit, because there are
rewards.
There are rewards there are 9 rewards out there that are based entirely on tags. Mm-hmm. Which is why that is kind of almost a second place thing for me. Whereas with when you go to Terraforming Mars not only has the milestones where you're competing to be the race to be the first to get this, but everything you put down on the board is points. Mm-hmm. when I put this forest next to this city, I am scoring points for the city, and I'm scoring points for the forest, and so on and so forth. So for me, of those three games, the ranking is Terraforming Mars first, Mosaic second.
Mosaic second.
Yes, and Ark Nova third. Realize, I will play any of these games anytime they're out. I love them all, but there is a definite hierarchy, and the hierarchy is entirely based not on theme design choices. It is entirely based on the level of game versus puzzle.
I put Terraforming Mars first as well. I think at the end, I've really grown to enjoy Ark Nova. At my first few plays of it, I was like, I don't know. But I really, really find it to be super fun. But to me, Terraforming Mars is number one by far. Yeah. Because not only the interaction, I just think it just does what those other two games do. It's just so straightforward. It's just classic for a reason, a modern classic.
100%. Totally agree. Here is something I hear sometimes in Ark Nova that I never hear in the other games. Oh, what were you doing over there in your zoo? Like, that would never happen in Terraforming Mars. I know exactly what you're doing because you built over there in mm-hmm. Noctis City, and I couldn't build my whole plan was ruined because you did that. In the same thing in Mosaic, it's like, I know exactly what you're doing because
I don't always know what's going on in Mosaic. Last time I played it, I was like, wait, Trey was just in the corner, literally in the corner of the table, just building up a tableau, and then all of a sudden he wins.
I guess with that exception, but I would say that for the most part, it's like, oh, you're in Gaul, and I know you're in Gaul because you had two more points than me, which is why I came in second, and I got almost no points in that region, right? There's a lot of that going on. You have this military, and
I think actually Terraforming Mars is a good example of how hard it is to make a game that is like really interactive and be successful. And the reason why I'm bringing it up is because actually one of the least successful aspects of Terraforming Mars are those random take that cards that are just thrown in there.
Yep.
And those are just like, they're very controversial. I know, I remember like there's several reviewers that really were like, what the hell? Because the it's clear that the designers threw those in there to be like, we need to have people interact. And I think it shows that, like, luckily the game has that map that has a huge amount of interaction. But a little game decision like that shows really how difficult it is to really make sure that while you're building this fun, interesting game, that people are still forced to interact with each other. And I think that, like, I'm not going to say, oh, there's more multiplayer solitaire games out because they're easier to design, because I don't think that's necessarily true. But I do think that probably the really, like, a really good interactive game that fires on all cylinders, I think it's tricky. You gotta like balance a lot of things. You gotta really make
play testing, right?
Yeah, you gotta make sure that like you create an ecosystem that works well. That's why Hegemony, which is you're so lucky, yours is arriving. I have no idea when mine's arriving.
Oh, speaking of deep breath in, and exhale.
But like that's a really exemplary design. Because,
ladies and gentlemen, my copy's coming on Tuesday. I'm so excited.
So jealous.
Are you coming to game night on Tuesday?
I am.
Oh,
are we playing
it? If it is in, we're playing it.
I'm very impressed with that design because I think when you have a game that's really interactive like that, it can just go totally lopsided and fall apart. And those, I think it's hard. Whether or not that explains why we're seeing, you know, might be seeing more games than a multiplayer solitaire, I'm not sure. That may just be a who knows? That may be a correlation more than anything else. But
Dimitri, do you have a strong preference between heavily interactive games and more multiplayer solitaire games?
I don't. Ultimately, my social interaction mm-hmm. At the table has more to do with my mood and who's there and what movie came out.
Yeah, okay, I get that.
Mercury in retrograde.
You know, I'm not saying I'm the most social person here, but I'm the person whose social enjoyment is the least, I believe, connected to what we're actually playing.
It's decoupled from the game.
Exactly.
There's no reason for me to interrupt. You're sharing something right now, and I just started to talk. Continue on.
I want to hear what you say.
No, I was just going to talk about Lowlands, the game Lowlands, which I know Candace is having a Lowlands moment right now. Jordan is having a moment.
Stop playing it. Yeah.
I hated it, and I loved it. Yeah.
Oh, it got up to love. I didn't realize it got up to love for you. It did?
Well,
I'm not saying that's a challenge. I'm actually fascinated.
It's like I have a, the game is the meat. I throw in spices and vinegar, and it kind of
okay, so
marinates in the brain until it becomes delicious.
Lowlands is a great example of a game that would be 100% puzzle forward, except it has this wonderful mechanic where, by the way, while you're doing your puzzle, your puzzle is going to be completely at odds with a central dilemma. And that fully elevates the game. I mean, that's just like a wonderful thing. Because again, I think that ultimately for me, I think what I like is I like a game that doesn't allow you just to recede into your own head. I don't mind a puzzle that you're doing by yourself, but there are, like I said before, there are ways, even when you're playing those games where you're just doing multiplayer solitaire, you can still have lots of table talk and interaction, but that's going to really rely on the people that are playing. And when you have games like Lowlands that say like, okay, you can do that, but at a certain point, we're going to force you to have a conversation with the people at the table. Yeah. Like, that's really awesome.
I think puzzles and games are diametrically opposed in one respect. Mm-hmm. A puzzle has a solution.
Mm. Ooh.
A game does not. A game does not. And like, if we say, oh yeah, Paul solved that game, it's not a good thing. You just said that about hegemony, that you don't really know which way it's going to go. It can go pear-shaped, whatever. You don't really... and a puzzle...
Pear-shaped society.
Is what did you say?
We have a pear-shaped society.
Exactly.
Currently.
We do. I mean, literally. Not you, Ben, but...
I got a pear growing here, don't worry.
In that, like figure skating versus hockey, right?
Yeah.
A perfect figure skating routine, you know exactly how it's going to go. It's for perfection. What the hell is a perfect hockey game? What happens? Is it a high-scoring game?
The U.S. collegiate team versus the Russians in 1980.
I was about to say.
I watched it. I'm old enough. I watched it in Chicago. My first year in America, it was mind-blowing. It was not perfect. In a perfect game, the Russians would have won. They were the much better team.
Oh, boo.
So I guess the reason...
Boo!
But I think in a game, the reason why when people say, oh, they solved it, the reason why people don't like that is because then it's like, what's the point of... what's the point of going back? Because you're always going to go down the same strategy, right?
What do you think the ratio of Paul claiming he solved a game to Paul actually having solved a game is?
100%.
Really?
100%. 100%, to quote you.
100%.
I don't know.
I'm going to go 15%.
Right. But there are some times.
Sure.
But there are.
It's actually somewhere between those. But what
17%.
My point is, if we say this game has been solved,
yeah,
we don't need to play it again. Yeah, one of
why not? Why can't you do a puzzle a second time?
Have you ever?
How many hours do you have in the day?
But why can't you? I haven't, but why can't you?
Why haven't you? Let's ask that.
I'll say, why haven't I? I think maybe the element of surprise and discovery is gone.
Yeah.
You know? Actually, no, I have done a puzzle multiple times. I used to have my aunt got me this puzzle of that famous New Yorker cover that shows like New York City. And it's like,
and everything else is like telescoping.
Exactly. And I actually have done that puzzle when I was a kid. I did it like two or three times. And there were puzzles I did two or three times. A, because it was like what I had to, it was something to do. And B, it was like fun to see the picture to come together.
But by and large, I
don't do puzzles multiple times.
Because once you know the trick, the challenge is largely gone.
Right.
To an example, escape rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Repeatability is a big problem for escape rooms. My daughter just humble brag a little bit. First of all, she got accepted into UC Berkeley.
Congratulations.
Yes. So we're super excited about that.
By the way, Jonathan Grotenstein's son got accepted into Berkeley, Sam.
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah, congrats, yeah, yeah. I know this has nothing to do with the games or with the podcast, but
I'm gonna have to reach out to him. That's amazing.
And you know, there might be a kind of a royal union or something.
I'm assuming both the kids want to go to Berkeley too. By the way, that's
yeah.
Okay, good.
Why wouldn't you? Do you know anyone who doesn't want to go to Berkeley? DeSantis.
Other than that, in any case. But she directed a Sony film this year, which means that she goes to Culver City High School. Sony Studios is in Culver City. And so they made a partnership with the high school where they would kind of, to some degree, give equipment and funding a little bit to five student films a year.
Oh, my God.
At the high school level.
Yeah.
So Leia wrote a script. It was really good. I gave her some input. She made a fantastic script. It was the overwhelming favorite chosen for the student films. It's called Escape, and it's essentially Breakfast Club in an escape room. It's a girl who has done escape rooms with her family her whole life that begs her friend, whatever you do, I know you're planning something for my birthday, just don't make it an escape room. And of course they make it an escape room, and she's mad at everybody. They eventually accidentally get locked into the escape room, can't get out, and they have to deal with their problems before they can figure a way out.
Wow. I mean, that
pretty good short concept, right?
Pitch that to big Sony, not student Sony.
So Jesse has worked on escape rooms.
Yes.
And so I reached out to Jesse and I said, hey, my daughter wrote this script. She needs to kind of film in an escape room. And obviously they could kind of build one and things like that, but it's not going to be that great. It's really hard to build as a good escape room set.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anybody that we could talk to that might have an escape room that's being renovated or something along those lines that is offline for the time being? He reached out to two friends, and one of them had two escape rooms that were in the process of being built and allowed us to film there. Hatch Escapes, by the way, Los Angeles. If you've never done Lab Rat, it's considered, I think it's the fourth best escape room in the world. They ranked them.
Dang.
It's crazy good. I've done it. It's incredible.
I was a Lab Rat in Station Falls. Just wanted everyone to know, but go on.
Anyway, we went and she made her film in an actual escape room, which was an amazing opportunity. But what we found out talking to them is the escape room that they're building takes up an entire floor of this warehouse. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to solve the repeatability problem with escape rooms, which is once you've done an escape room, you're never going to do that escape room again.
Yeah.
Because you know the tricks, you know the secrets, it's all done. Well, what this escape room does is it's got like six different rooms. It's this huge place. And you can do it on the puzzle track or on the challenge track, essentially. I'm not sure if I'm using the terms correctly. But it can operate as an escape room, as a one-time only do it and figure things out. But in each room, there are tasks that you need to perform. And you get a score based on that. And depending on what your score is, as you go through these different levels, you're unlocking new endings.
Mm-hmm.
You're unlocking new situations. In fact, there is an entire room that you could do this escape room three or four times and never even see until you were able to unlock it. So that is an example of a puzzle and a game, and mm-hmm. the game is the repeatable one.
Right. I mean, it's like
very much in terms of what Dimitri is saying.
Well, listen, remember, you know, when we were younger, video games were sort of, you would sit down and they were, you know, you would play the same game over and over again. I played Super Mario Brothers, Super Mario Brothers 2, 3. Because you would sit down, you wouldn't really save the games. There were some games you would save, like Zelda, or maybe you'd have like a passcode, like on Mega Man. But basically, you play and you play all the way through.
Yep.
And you just do it again and again and again. And you have your methods and everything. And one could say you've solved Super Mario Brothers. But like, it's all about the efficiency of it. That's why we have speed runs for video games. Mm-hmm. But we don't do that for board games. And so when people say, oh, I solved it, you know, we just sort of say, oh, there's no point in it. Because I think what we want is, we're always talking about how we want variability. We want a multitude of experiences. We want to be able to go down all these different paths. And like, why do we prioritize that? Why is that more valuable to us than saying like, oh, there's one way to do this game? And I understand why. I understand why. It's just not as fun.
Yeah.
But like, why is it not as fun? Like, what is it that we seek as gamers and as people that gets totally totally you know, hurt or that we are pushing back against when we solve, quote unquote, solve a game. Is it easier to solve a game that is interactive or one that is multiplayer solitaire?
My point is that the more interactive a game is, the harder it is to solve.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To an extent, a solution is not even the point. But the more puzzly a game is, the solution becomes the point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, in Horseless Carriage,
mm-hmm.
it's very conceivable that there are ideal factories for.
I mean, I'm not sure "ideal" is the right word.
Peaks. There are
certainly better and worse designs.
Yeah, and in fact, Trey confessed
cheated
on the podcast. Why? Why is that cheating? He's doing research.
Looking up other people's solutions using them.
We're all writers. We do research. We go on the internet and we see certain, you know, the top 15 tricks of how to build a factory in Horseless Carriage. That's the hallmark of a puzzle. Chess is really only a game in the middle. There's standard openings.
End games and openings, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then there are end games
And people, by the way, don't like that in board games. People will say, ugh, the beginning of this game is so scripted. Yeah. You know, they don't like that. I think there's like this element that we like to think that we have free will and we can create our own destinies with these games and it's up to us. And if the game can be put on rails,
yeah.
I think we actually feel disempowered by it in a weird way when it comes to board games. And we feel like we don't even have any agency. Like you're playing Underwater Cities without the expansion. It's like, oh, you got to go with the kelp strategy. And if one person's going the kelp strategy, we all have to do that. And which is oddly enough, that's kind of interactive for that. Oh, one person's doing the kelp strategy, the solvable strategy. So we now all have to interrupt them, which is peak interaction, but we don't like it because it's interaction against what we want to do. So we all kind of want to be able to create our own narratives, which is actually very multiplayer solitaire. But we also want to create our narratives, but have our narratives be interrupted by everyone else.
I think that, yeah, that a game that is going to, that we're going to want to play again and again and again is almost always going to be a game in which there are wide varieties to play the game. And there are a wide variety of moments in which we can switch the track we're on and play on it mm-hmm. on a different track, switch strategies as we go. And the more of those that are viable, the deeper and richer the decision space is and the more long-lasting that game is going to feel to us.
Trey always talks about a book by an author whose name I forget who talks about mastery or consolidation.
Jordan Peterson.
That's right. No.
Jessica Simpson.
No, please. Mastery, not mastery. Whatever. Jordan Peterson's a fucking asshole. But
I don't know who that is. That's, by the way, not our Jordan, just so everyone knows.
No, that is not our Jordan. Our Jordan is a sweet, nice person.
In fact, don't look up Jordan Peterson.
Dimitri is off of Jordan Peterson. That's what
he wants you to do.
Ever since Dimitri started listening to Andrew Tate, he is no longer on the Jordan Peterson trail.
So, in any case.
Guys.
Final
thoughts, because we do need to wrap it up, but
sure. Wonderful to be here with you guys, of course. Wonderful to have a conversation on a Saturday afternoon. Can't think of a better way to spend it. Maybe play a game, of course. But I think that we had three games going on simultaneously.
Yes.
Last night. Who finished way, way, way first? The first time they played the game.
The Earth.
Yes. Puzzly games have a way of packaging complexity in a manageable package. In my opinion, I
can't really comment on whether games are becoming more or less interactive, you know, because it all depends on what games maybe we're playing, maybe what games we're not playing, etc. I mean, 18xx games are still coming out, but those aren't coming out on Friday nights, you know, so there's still plenty of super interactive, wonderful games out there. But I think it is really interesting to look at these the divide between sort of like multiplayer solo and highly interactive games and see what it says about us and what we value in gaming experiences, what we get out of it. And I also want to say that I do think that, like, you know, people can make interaction even when things are not interactive. I just one last little example, Concordia, mm-hmm. my number one game of all time.
Sure.
Amazing. It's actually a very interactive game on its
own.
And
elegant.
And elegant. But, you know, forever, I would always do the strategy of I would collect these two types of cards, Mars cards and Mercurius. And it was just a great combo. I might have been able to say I'd solved it. And my friend Daria saw that that's what I would do. So she would just start interrupting me and she would start to claim it. And I have to change my whole strategy. And so that's...
By the way, this is what you've done with us in Avalon.
Be a disruptor if I can. And the thing is there are ways to generate interaction and to find interaction games. And I think it's really important for people to find those paths. But
there's almost no puzzle to Concordia, by the way. There's almost nothing.
It's not an efficiency puzzle to you?
Oh, no. There's almost nothing that you're doing that is entirely dependent on everything everybody else is doing. Like, literally, there's everything that...
I think there's still a puzzle. There's a puzzle of, like, I need to build houses here. I need to do it as efficiently as possible. So I need to get, like, how can I go from point A to point B? Like, what steps do I have to do to arrange everything to make sure everything is where it needs to be and try to do it as quickly as possible because someone's going to mess me up.
Right, but those houses that you need to build are on a board that is dynamic because everyone else is playing on the same board, and at any moment, somebody could build a house on that place before you, and then suddenly you don't have enough resources to build that house.
Puzzle gets messed up. It's like someone takes a piece out of your jigsaw puzzle.
Which is why I said it's not really a puzzle. That is still... those are all kind of game elements, right, in the sense that there's no unmolested little box that you have that you can work in.
I mean, so in conclusion, I would say everyone should own a copy of Concordia because it's the best game of all time.
It's amazing. It is amazing.
I thought Catan was.
No, Catan was my number one for a very long time.
The day after the designer dies, you betray... You're the Judas. You betray...
Catan was my number one for a very long time. It's now Concordia, followed by, I think, like Railways of the World or... 18XX game, but either way, that's a different story. That's a different game.
And my final thought is that I want to thank you guys for going on this journey. I know that just this morning I said, I kind of want to talk about this, and you guys just leapt on that horse and rode it until it died. I mean, thank you for that. I would really appreciate that.
Give us a platform to pontificate for 2 hours, and that's what we'll do.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Only I really enjoyed it.
We're done pontificating?
Everybody,
happy Easter, happy Passover.
Happy Ramadan.
Happy Ramadan. Happy International Women's Day, which was, I guess a couple weeks ago. But still.
Happy Earth Day coming up.
Earth Day coming up, absolutely. I like games that are less puzzles and more games because I like seeing what people come up with as opposed to a design coming up with. I find people utterly and completely fascinating almost all the time. Almost all the time.
And by the way, would love to hear what people think on our Discord. Go join our Discord for Game Brain.
Oh, we have a Facebook group. We have a Discord channel. Please let us know what you think. We'd love hearing about you. And please definitely on Facebook, post those pictures of your copies of Gemini as they come in. Because every time you post a copy of Hegemony that you received, a little piece of Ben dies. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to Game Brain, produced and edited by Matthew Robinson, Tom Donnelly, Trey Alsop, and Ben Manilker. Special thanks to Daedalus for our incredible music. More on Daedalus at GameBrainPod.com. Thanks to Edamar Peleg for our incredible graphics. Kerbaloni.com is where you can find him. You can reach us by email at contact@GameBrainPod.com or on Twitter at GameBrain_pod. Thanks so much for listening, and go play some games with friends.
And go make some friends with puzzles.